If any of you are interested in a general reference about geology that kind of covers the kinds of things we've been talking about this week, and in any of the different aspects of geology, this is one I grabbed from a colleague at work. It's a new text, actually by one of the co-authors, of a former professor of mine from the University of Washington. It's called The Dynamic Earth by Brian Skinner and Steve Porter. It is a remarkably well-written general textbook on geology, and I've been using it as a reference to kind of get myself refreshed on some of this material, and I find it to be a very, very good book, and I would recommend it if any of you are interested in getting it. I did not order it for the bookstore here, so you can't get it next door. I don't know if we're being taped today or not, but I'm ready to go if you are. Okay, so let me start then with talking about what glaciers are. And before I can talk about the glaciers, I have to say a few things about snow, because that's what is the building block of glaciers. Obviously, we're in an area that gets a fair amount of snow in the wintertime. And when snow falls and accumulates in some thickness, it can change its character. The actual little grains of ice will change. And in fact, we can view snow or ice crystals as a metamorphic mineral, much in the same way we've been talking about metamorphic rocks here in forming the Cascade Range. Ice is the natural occurring form of a chemical compound in nature, which is sort of a definition of a mineral. And when powder snow falls, it has a very low density. It's about a tenth of the density of liquid water. It's about 0.1 grams per cubic centimeter. And water is 1.0 grams per cubic centimeter. As snow accumulates in a big, thick snowpack, two things happen. One is that the weight of the overlying snow presses down on it. And second is, while it's still porous, air can circulate in among the grains, and some of that ice actually evaporates. And then will recondense over very short distances when that vapor runs into new, slightly cooler spots within the snowpack. So the ice grains change their shape from the lacy, lightweight snowflakes to basically little ice pellets. And in Europe, they call that corn snow when it gets to be pelletized. And that's simply a function of time, generally, and a little bit of warming and cooling. If you're a skier, we call it spring snow. The ice grains are more rounded. Now, if we pack that stuff in deeper and deeper accumulations, eventually those grains start to recrystallize together and start to form more solid and larger ice crystals, which are interconnected with each other. There's increasingly less and less pore space and less air in it, and it becomes more and more dense. And so ultimately we reach a thickness where the stuff is basically pure recrystallized ice, and the density is all the way up to the maximum density that ice can achieve, which is 0.9 grams per cubic centimeter. Still, as you know, a little bit less dense than liquid water. That's why ice cubes float. So that's the stuff that makes up glaciers, is when it gets to that crystalline ice form. Now, a glacier itself is simply a mass of ice up on a hillside somewhere that moves, that flows. Ice is actually a fluid. It's a plastic fluid that has a very high strength. And engineers talk about plastics in this sense. It's plastic, or any material is a plastic if it sits and appears to be rigid under normal conditions. But if you apply a force to it, like if I put a big heavy chunk of iron on this material that's sitting in front of me, and if it deforms under the weight of that material, we call it a plastic. And then if you take the weight away, it freezes in that shape and doesn't change again. That's what ice does, but it flows and deforms under its own weight. It doesn't take anything external. So if we look at the cross-section of a mountain, maybe like one we have here in the Cascades, and we have lots of snow accumulating in the wintertime up here, the snowpack accumulates, and eventually we get enough mass, enough weight, to form ice, and we have a glacier mass. So let's assume this is the glacier here sitting on the bedrock. And there are several features to a glacier that we can talk about. First of all, just sort of its geometry, it has a toe or a terminus which fluctuates. It moves up and down, uphill and downhill, and a head, and that usually stays pretty much the same. There will be a point on the glacier. Let's just, for the sake of argument, say it's here, where on the average winter, more snow accumulates uphill of that line than melts. And downhill of that line, more of the snow melts than accumulates. So we have net accumulation of snow here, we have net loss of snow here. And we call this the equilibrium line. That's just the line that defines that difference. And this line is pretty much the same as what we call the snow line. If you look up in the mountains, just about this time of year, we're late in the summer season. The snow has retreated about as far up the mountain as it's going to retreat before the winter snows come again and start bringing the snow down again. That's the snow line, and that's a climactic feature of this particular area. And so that's about usually about the same here on average as this equilibrium line. Now, by definition, each year this equilibrium line changes on a glacier. In a very warm winter and hot summer, this equilibrium line could shift way up here so that the only snow that's accumulating in a net sense is just right up here at the head, and all the rest of it is melting. And in a cold year, it could shift way down to the toe. So, that's just the concept of it. So we have ice building up here. We have ice, on average, melting from down here. And that causes a, shall we say, a disequilibrium. If nothing else happened, we'd just get a big mass of ice growing up here, and then this would just melt down to nothing, right? But because I said it can flow under its own weight, what we do is we eventually get flow lines that on average kind of look like this. The ice at this upper part is flowing mostly down because it's accumulating, and here it's flowing mostly up because it's melting away. The rates of flow of ice vary quite a bit, but I would say in most glaciers, in an area like this, it can be 10 to 15 feet a year, is sort of a good figure. As I've drawn it here, here's a sort of a hump in the bedrock underneath, and often what this will do is cause cracks to form in the ice that's flowing over it, because near the surface, where the weight of the ice is not so great, the ice behaves as a brittle solid rather than a plastic solid. And you get these series of parallel cracks opening up as the ice moves over a positive feature of topography. And those crevasses are some of the easiest ways you can look up at a mountainside and tell whether or not a snow patch, or what looks like a snow patch, is simply that, or if it's really a glacier. Snowfields don't have crevasses, and glaciers do. And sometime if you're walking up on the second level, you can look up the valley, and you can quite clearly see the Mary Green Glacier, which is the small glacier over Holden Lake, and the crevasses are very obvious at this time of year as you look up there. Quite open. And then we talk, or glaciologists anyway, talk about the mass balance, which is the net balance of the accumulation versus the melting on a glacier for any given year. And it's kind of like a checking account. It's the what you put in at the top and what you take out at the bottom. And they keep track of that with very detailed measurements on glaciers. Okay, there's another aspect to this which is interesting, and that is that there is a response time which might not be so obvious. Because these things flow slowly, let's say we had 5 years of especially heavy snowfall up in the accumulation zone, we would not see a response to the glacier right away. And that's because it takes a while for that stuff to compact, to turn to ice, for the weight to be translated into accelerated flow speeds, and for us to actually see an advance of the glacier. And we talk about advance and retreat of the terminus as the movement that is obvious. And it might take anywhere from a few years to a few decades for that pile of extra snow that accumulated over a few years to actually be translated into movement down here at the bottom. Alternatively, if we had a series of very warm years and we got more melting and our mass balance was changed so that it was negative, it would still, the terminus wouldn't change for quite a while until that difference in the mass balance was able to be translated through the flowing of the ice. So the terminus moves up and down the valley in response to this change in mass balance. The ice is always flowing downhill. It never stops moving downhill. It's just that when it advances, there's more ice coming down that can melt, and when it retreats, the melting is going on faster than it can be replenished by the flow. I was up at Holden Lake just a few days ago, and one of the people that was up there with me said that she had been here as a teenager about 20 years ago, and that the Mary Green Glacier was way, way further down, closer to Holden Lake then than it is today. And that would fit with what we know about glaciers in the Cascades. They have been retreating very rapidly over the last few decades. Okay, then just a little bit of talk about some of the features, the sediments that the glaciers leave behind. Glaciers do move a lot of sediment, a lot of rock debris, and they do it in several ways. One is that they, as they move along the bed, they incorporate other stones and rocks into the ice, and that as they slide along the bed, you have rocks that are in the ice grinding and sliding against rocks that are in the bed. And that friction causes a lot of erosion. It causes gouging and scouring of the rock surface. Big chunks of rock break off. And that rock, that new rock debris, will actually get frozen up into the ice and will follow these flow lines out toward the surface eventually. And so we'll get piles of rock accumulating on the lower part of the glacier. And in most glaciers in mountains like this, the lower ends of the glaciers are often completely covered with rock debris. You don't even see the ice. You just see a bunch of boulders, but there's ice underneath it. And this ice has both come from the bed up along these flow lines, or we get rock falls and rock avalanches. Rocks kind of fall down the mountainside, they land on top of the glacier, and then they just go for a ride there. Interesting story. In World War II, there was a training flight from the Air Force, training some pilots for World War II, and they were flying around Mount Rainier. The plane crashed at the head of one of the glaciers, the Nisqually Glacier at Mount Rainier, and fell into a crevasse. And so they were only able to recover a few of the bodies, and all of the plane was down there, and quickly became entombed in the ice. And that was way up here, say, on this map. Well, about 7 or 8 years ago, chunks of airplanes started appearing down here. And that, and it had been all torn to pieces, and the biggest piece anybody ever found was about, you know, the size of a dinner plate. But that was the remains of that airplane, and it had flowed all the way down through the, to the bottom, and then up again in this glacier. And giving us an idea of about how long for that particular glacier it takes for stuff to flow that far. Glaciers in the North Cascades are a type of glacier we call temperate glaciers, and they are usually at the freezing point, or actually a little above the freezing point at their bin. So there's usually meltwater at the bin. On the other hand, glaciers in places like Antarctica, where it's very, very cold, are polar glaciers, and they're usually frozen to the bin. And so in the mountains here, glaciers move relatively faster than in polar areas, because their movement includes both the deformation flow within the ice, and also we get sliding at the base. And that can move it along fairly quickly. Whereas in Antarctica or in Greenland, the glacier can only flow through just internal deformation. There's also a feature that you might have read about recently in the paper called a glacier surge. And there's a big glacier in Alaska which is surging at the present time, and it made the news just a few weeks ago. They're not quite sure why these things occur, but what happens is that a glacier's going along, flowing at, you know, a few tens of feet per year, and all of a sudden it just picks up and starts falling down the valley. It can move a couple miles in a year. They can actually sit there and watch this thing move. And as I said, they don't know exactly what is going on, but they think what is happening is that water gets trapped at the base. And if it can't escape, the water pressure builds up and builds up, and you can actually jack the whole weight of the glacier up off the rock onto this water. It's like tires hydroplaning on a highway. The water gets trapped there. The friction is then taken, or the weight is taken by the water, and so the friction is reduced tremendously. And so suddenly this finds a frictionless bed in part of its part of its mass, and it starts taking off. Okay. When glaciers advance and retreat, they do so over fairly long periods of time. They'll advance for quite a number of years or decades, and then they'll retreat for quite a few decades or centuries. And whenever a glacier stops or reaches a fairly stable position for a while, the ice keeps flowing, the terminus stays in the same place, all this debris keeps coming out in the flow, and it cascades down the steep front of the glacier, and eventually at the toe you get a pile of boulders and rocks and debris out at the front, which really doesn't have any ice. It might have a little bit of ice under it, but mostly it's just rocks. Then when the glacier retreats, doesn't do much, does it? Let's say it retreats up to here, then we've got this ridge that has a fairly steep uphill side to it and a more gentle downhill side to it. And we call those terminal moraines. And those are sort of fossil records, if you will, of the positions of past ice fronts. And in mountains such as this, we often have three or four or more of these terminal moraines showing us where steady state positions have been in the past of the terminuses. In, let's say, starting in about 1250 AD and ending in the middle of the 19th century, there was a period worldwide of general cooling of the earth and general advance of glaciers. So much so it was called the Little Ice Age. It reached its peak in about the 1600s. And glaciers in the Alps and in North America and everywhere advanced as far as they ever have since the last major ice age, leaving these moraines. And so in Copper Basin, for example, there you go up and over one of these Little Ice Age moraines getting up into the basin. Now, glaciers come in all sizes and shapes. Basically, it has to be cold to produce them. And we can get ground cold in two ways. We can either put it up in the air, put it high, or we can move it into the extreme latitudes, north or south latitudes of the Earth. And around here, the most typical kind of glacier is, well, let's see, maybe I see how my drawing is here. Let's say this is a ridge and we're kind of looking toward it, and here's a basin with a creek coming down, and here's another one. In the Cascades, the most typical kind of glacier we have here is a cirque glacier, and these glaciers basically just occupy these upper zones in these upper basins. They never get very long, and the Mary Green Glacier is a very good example of it. And they'll just stay at this small size for years and years. Underneath the cirque glaciers, the ice again is constantly flowing, it's constantly having that almost a rotational kind of movement over time. And when these things eventually melt away, they leave a depression that usually catches water. And those we call glacial cirque basins, and the lakes are usually called tarns. And that's why we have so many nice little beautiful lakes in a mountain range like the North Cascades, because there have been cirque glaciers up there, most of which have melted away, leaving the lakes behind. If the glacier extends further down the valley, we call it a valley glacier, and they sometimes extend out onto the flats that are at the bottom of the valley, and in this case they tend to spread out in big areas like that. When they do that, they're called Piedmont glaciers. Those are the types of glaciers we usually get in the mountains. In extreme examples, the whole upper part of the mountain range can be covered in ice, with only the very peaks sticking up through it. Those are called ice caps. A good example of that would be the Columbia Ice Field in southwestern British Columbia. They have a large ice cap up there. I don't know the total area, but it is quite large. And you get valley glaciers extending down in different directions from the ice cap, down in different valleys. And then in the polar regions, we get the ice sheets, which are continental-sized masses of ice, which can be as much as 10,000 feet thick, and basically cover everything. And only just tiny little bits of mountain ranges stick up out of the top. Those little things that stick up are called nunataks, and that's an Eskimo word, because those guys deal with them a fair amount. If you've ever flown to Europe, over Greenland, the polar route to Europe, you fly over southern Greenland, you have some beautiful views of nunataks sticking up out of the Greenland ice sheet as you fly. Okay. Oh, one interesting thing about ice sheets in general. Today, this is in metric units, about 24 million cubic kilometers of ice is presently bound up in ice sheets and glaciers and all the ice around the world. That's a pretty big number. I don't know what it would be in cubic miles, but if it were to melt, if all our ice sheets were to melt, it would raise sea level about 200 feet, which would cause some fairly drastic changes to our coastline. Okay, let me then shift gears slightly, and I'll talk a little bit about ice ages. In the early 19th century, really it was first in Europe and then later in North America, geologists started recognizing features in the landscape, particularly in the Midwest, that they felt was evidence of glaciers having been much, much larger than they are today, and in fact existing in places where they don't exist today. And some of the first work of this was done on the plains in front of the Alps, where they saw that the glaciers had been way down onto the flats in Europe, whereas today they're, you know, way up high in the mountains. And at first, this theory of former glacier ages, ice ages, was poo-pooed by geologists, but eventually the evidence became overwhelming, and it became an accepted theory, or as we feel today, pretty much a fact. And it's interesting, if we look at the last, say, 60 million years of Earth history, that's a period of time we call the Cenozoic, and that's the last major epoch of Earth history, starting pretty much from the time the dinosaurs died out up to today. Climate around the world has been generally warming. It was warm then, it's been generally cooling since then. And then about 2 million years ago, we entered into a series of more rapid fluctuations of temperature and climate, which caused these so-called ice ages. The early geologists thought that this had happened only four times, because going out into the mountains, you see at most four major sets of moraines in the valleys where glaciers had previously been. But using evidence from deep sea drilling, using oxygen isotope data, and that data is based on the assumption that when a lot of the water is bound up in ice sheets, and we've removed a fair amount of water from the ocean, we have concentrated the heavy isotopes of oxygen, in particular oxygen 18, is more concentrated with respect to normal oxygen, which is oxygen 16, and so that we have this ratio that's heavy on the 18 side, whereas in times when the glaciers have all melted, we're back to a ratio that's fairly heavy on the lightweight side, the oxygen 16 side. And by going down, drilling down into sediments in the ocean floor, we can go back many millions of years. The water that is in those sediments is water that was trapped at the time those sediments fell. And so by doing an isotope analysis of the water, we can measure the ratios of these two different isotopes. And we find a fluctuation of these isotopes, which just about coincides exactly with the fluctuation of the ice ages, at least for the ones we're most familiar with, the most recent ones. But the interesting thing of this record is that it shows that these fluctuations occurred more than 20 times over the last 2 million years. So it's not just four major ice ages, but at least 20 major ice ages have occurred on Earth in the last 2 million years. These fluctuations generally last about 100,000 years. And the times where the ice is everywhere we call glacial times, and the times when the world is fairly ice-free we call interglacial times. Right now we are right at the peak of an interglacial time. We are at about as warm as we're going to get relative to the last few hundreds of thousands of years. And if the cycle keeps going as we might expect it to, 2,000 years, we would expect to start entering back into an ice age again, one of these glacial times. We don't know exactly how quickly it takes this to happen, but we suspect it is on the order of many hundreds, if not thousands of years, for this really to occur. But I think we're all aware that the climate has been very crazy for the last 5 years or so, and a lot of people are wondering if this might not be, you know, the precursor of our entering into another ice age. Interestingly, it doesn't take too great a depression of world temperature to actually cause us to enter into an ice age. Somewhere between 4 and 10 degrees Celsius worldwide average temperature drop is all that it takes. The eruption of Mount Pinatubo, just in 1991, put a lot of dust, volcanic dust, up in the atmosphere, and it, having dust up in the atmosphere, scatters incoming solar radiation and prevents it from coming down to the Earth, and so it causes a general cooling. That eruption, that dust from Mount Pinatubo, caused a depression of worldwide temperature about 1 degree, which, you know, was somewhat significant. Had it been a bigger eruption, it might have been more. And in fact, there was a much larger eruption in Indonesia in 1815 called Tambora. That eruption caused a worldwide depression of several degrees, and the effects were that in Europe and North America, in the following summer, 1816, the New Englanders called it 1800 and froze to death, the year without a summer. There was snowfall and killing frosts in June, July, and August, and famine in much of Vermont and New Hampshire, upstate New York. So we're still, you know, the research that's going on right now is still right on the cutting edge of trying to understand what all this is and how it happens and what causes these ice ages to form. The astronomers think that one of the major reasons ice ages form have to do with variations in both the rotation and the revolution of the Earth in its cycle, in its journey around the Sun. It's recognized that the orbit of the Earth is not exactly perfectly circular. It has a certain amount of eccentricity to it, and there is a certain a cyclicity of this eccentricity in the orbit. They also have been able to determine that the tilt of the Earth's axis, its rotational axis, isn't always exactly the same. It's about 23.5 degrees now, but it can vary a couple degrees on either side of that. And that variation over time also is cyclic. So that's another cycle. And then the third one that they found is the rotation, annual rotation year to year, actually causes a slight wobbling in the axis. And that's a third cycle periodicity that can be mapped out. And if you combine all three of these different cycles, you add them all together in these curves, you come up with a combined curve which very closely mimics the known curve for glaciations. So it's thought that these are a major contributor to kicking us into glacial periods. There are other things that affect it. Greenhouse gases are a factor, and air samples of trapped air in the ice, in the deep ice sheets, has been analyzed and has been found to contain less carbon dioxide, which is a greenhouse gas, than it does today. And we don't understand why the atmosphere had less CO2 in those days than it does today, but apparently it did. Another factor is that during ice ages, the air tends to be dustier. And that's because with a lot of glacial action, we get a lot of outwash, and that's just the sediment from these tills and moraines that washes out onto the flats below glaciers. It looks very much like these tailing piles do. It's a lot of very fine, loose sediment. When the wind comes up, it picks it up and blows it and causes dust storms. And worldwide, these dust storms can cause the air to be quite hazy. And again, that's sort of a feedback mechanism during the advance of glaciers that helps keep the air or the temperature cool.
Can you stand and wait till I finish, please? Okay. You stand and wait.
So,
oh, I've got a question.
Yeah, friend.
Something that I've read about in the past few years is this idea that polar shifts, where there's a different, like the magnetic readings in the rocks actually go to an opposite direction. That sometimes has been known to, I guess, trigger glaciation or something. What can you shed on that?
Well, it is true. We know in studying the record of magnetism that's recorded in rocks As you know, the Earth has a magnetic field, and when a lava that contains iron-bearing minerals cools and freezes, there's a tendency for the iron-bearing minerals to align themselves to the magnetic field. And we can both get the direction of the magnetic field from that, we can also get the polarity. So we know that the North Pole is the North Pole, and the South Pole is the South Pole. But in examining older rocks back through the ages, geologists have found that suddenly there'll be these periods where you cross over a boundary, and suddenly all the rocks below that boundary will show the North Pole pointing south. And the polarity of the whole Earth's magnetic field reversed. And it has happened many, many times throughout the Earth's history. We don't understand why this happens. We have not yet lived through, as a human species, we've not yet lived through one of these reversals. The last one was about 800,000 years ago. I don't know. There may be some who relate that to glaciation, but I don't know if there's a connection there or not to ice ages. Yeah, if you have any other questions here, shout them out. One other factor that's kind of interesting with these ice sheets, and the major ice sheets in the world during the last glaciation, the last major ice age we had, which was started about 30,000 years ago and ended about 12,000 years ago. In North America, most of that ice was centered over central eastern Canada. And it was called the... I'm blanking out here.
Wisconsin.
Well, it was the Wisconsin glaciation.
The Cordillera ice,
there's another word for it.
Laurentian? Laurentian?
Laurentian, thank you. The Laurentian ice sheet. The Cordilleran one was in the west coast, centered over the Rocky Mountains in that area. This ice sheet, which was a major continental ice sheet, and was probably similar to the Greenland ice sheet today, with thicknesses up to 10,000 feet in thickness, spread out down into central United States, down as far as about New York City in the east. I'm not from the Midwest, and so I don't know where the furthest extent of the ice went in the Midwest. I'm guessing it would be down around just southern Minnesota.
South of Madison.
Okay.
There's a place in northern Minnesota called the Laurentian Divide, where the rivers north of that flow north and the one south goes south. Would that be where it is?
No, it's down around St. Paul.
It would
too,
be a bit further south than that.
Because there's debris.
That divide would probably be, that's a topographic divide that probably was partly caused by the shifting of material by the ice as it flowed.
Would the Black Hills have been part of that, formed by that time?
No, the Black Hills are something else again.
Okay.
And one of the things that these massive ice sheets, there was another massive ice sheet centered in Scandinavia that extended down into Central Europe. And there was one in Central Asia, Russia, that extended down into Central Asia. So these very thick ice sheets can actually, because the weight is so great, it can actually depress the Earth's crust, push it down. And then relative to the elasticity of the crust, that ice melts away fairly fast in a few thousand years. And it takes a long time for the crust then to rebound due to this elastic rebound. And in fact, Central Canada is still rebounding. Scandinavia is still rebounding, coming up, bouncing back from the time the ice was sitting on it. That rebound is still very fast in Scandinavia. It's coming up a few centimeters per year. Rebound from that.
What do you mean it rebounds? Does it go out in the mountains and stuff? Or?
Well, it's like you push a beach ball in a swimming pool underwater, and there's a buoyant effect, and then you take your hands off of it, and it bounces back up again. Well, in this case, the crust is the beach ball, the ice is doing the pushing down, but because the crust of the Earth is so thick and viscous and and strong, it can only rebound very slowly. It's still coming up.
What's the effect of that?
Yeah, is it form hills or mountains or rivers?
Well, one effect is that the coastline, no, generally over the immediate area, you don't see any change. It's just that the overall crust in that area is coming up, and coasts are retreating away. And so you get coastlines which change their position. The retreat was even more of an effect earlier in prehistory. And sea level rise following glaciation, sea level drop following glaciation due to this overall rebound. And it's also partly confused in places by tectonic forces in the crust, which also cause the crust to go up and down, can cause big changes in geography and history. The town of Ephesus was a seaport back in biblical times, and I understand, I've never been there, but I understand today that the ocean coast is quite a few miles from Ephesus in southern Turkey.
Western Finland has gained about 10 or 20 miles of extra land by the slow rise. It's extremely flat land, and the Gulf of Bothnia is very shallow there, so as it comes up just a few centimeters, you get a lot of extra territory.
Yeah. Alternatively, when we're in a maximum glacial time and a lot of seawater is being used up to make the glaciers in the first place, it causes sea level to drop just from the difference. And I've got some numbers on that here. During the last ice age, world sea level fell about 300 feet due to that. And on the Atlantic coast, the Atlantic coast was 90 miles east of New York City at the time. Sea level dropped so far that England and France were joined together as one solid piece of land. Alaska and Siberia, eastern Siberia, were joined together. And you've probably heard that during the ice ages, when that happened a number of different times, that was the main migration path for people into the New World. It was Eskimo Indian type people coming from northern Siberia down into Alaska. And there was actually an ice-free corridor because it was so dry up in northern Canada during the time. The glacial ice wasn't up there. It was further south, even though it was quite cold up there. And so there were ways for people to travel, bands of hunters and over the centuries. And probably on several different occasions, on different ice ages, that different groups of people came. And so...
I thought you said there's only like one ice age during
history. No, many. About 20. The last ice age was the one that started about 30 million years ago and ended about 30,000 years ago, ended about 12,000 years ago. That was the last major ice age.
So you're talking about minor ice ages then?
Well, they're all major. They're all major.
200 million years or something.
Well,
2 million years ago.
Right, okay. 2 million years ago, we entered into a time of ice ages. But there were many fluctuations of the climate during that time, and we know that there were at least 20 ice ages during that 2 million year period. And interestingly, there were other ice ages even earlier in the Earth's history. There are rock deposits which indicate glaciation on the Earth's surface as far back as 2.5 billion years ago, way early in the Earth's history. And there have been about 5 or 6 major periods of glaciation in the Earth's history up through time. Now, a lot of this probably relates to continental drift. And during the time of the dinosaurs, we call it the Mesozoic period, we don't know of any ice ages anywhere in the world. And that's probably because the continents were all in fairly low-latitude positions due to continental drift. And since that time, a lot of the continents have been moving further toward the poles. And so that's a chance for the glaciation to occur. So.
You need to wait a minute now. Okay, I'm sorry. You need to wait a minute. Okay.
So I think that is basically what I've got for you here today. Do you have any questions? Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Let's say we get to another ice age and another nice big glacier lands on top of Canada, and it's going to essentially squish that civilization into, till it retreats, right?
The pieces of that is big.
not that people would get squished, but the idea being that, there'll just be a continual snowfall and finally...
Well,
I'm just looking at
trying to look for some land in Arizona.
The one thing we know is as these changes are, at least in terms of the ice advancing, it takes a long time. It takes thousands of years for the ice to advance. However, we don't really understand too well how the climate fluctuations that actually cause the ice age, how quickly those come on and how they could affect us. See, we could start having a series of cold years with real crummy summers, and
like this year,
or even a little worse, and so that world food production starts going down because of climatic problems. And it's not just being cold, but some areas get much too much water, like the Midwest this year, and fields get flooded out. Other areas dealing with droughts, and so we may have to respond a bit more quickly to those kinds of changes. But in terms of the ice coming and rumbling over Toronto, that's, people will have time to react to that.
Don't call beacons just
What is known about the climate during an ice age? Obviously, there's a lot of snowfall in certain zones, and you mentioned that in northern Canada, it was actually dry, so dry that there wasn't any snow or ice in the night. What about more tropical regions? What is it about the climate during an ice age in those regions?
There's a lot of research going on what they call paleoclimates, what the climate was like at different times in the past. I'm just not really all that familiar with that research. We know that some areas were a lot wetter. The Sahara, for example, was quite a moist area, probably during the last ice age. And today it's very dry. So there's a lot out there, and we're sorting it all out now. But climate was very different during the ice ages, and will probably change some more, even in our lifetimes, to some degree. Yeah?
Just thinking, for instance, up in Alaska, the Mendenhall, for instance, is that slipping? Is that what it's happening with the water underneath it? It just... Because there's so much capping going on, you just feel like it's going to fall before your eyes, And I was just wondering, is it because of a lot of water flow? It's just underneath it, what you were saying, something about it sliding.
Yeah. The calving of a fjord glacier, such as the Mendenhall, that's where the glacier extends down the valley and out into a body of water so that the ice is actually floating on the water. And if the position is stable for a while, the end of the glacier starts building its own little bank of sediment that it can rest on. And that stabilizes the end. And if the glacier front gets pushed off by advance or pulled back by retreat, it gets pulled off its little stable pad of sand and gravel and is much more susceptible to calving then because of the stresses of the water, going up and down with the tides and that sort of thing. And it will cause it to calve more.
Does it look like it was falling way before our eyes?
Well, they do. Some of them are quite active now. I don't know if the Mendenhall, is that the one that's surging now or not? There's one up there that is surging at present time, and that would also cause a lot of calving to go on.
What is calving?
Calving is just the ice, the glacier is pushed out and is floating on the water, and then big chunks of the ice are falling off into the sea and becoming icebergs. And that's where icebergs come from. And of course, they're pretty dangerous for shipping and with all the oil tankers that are up there in the Gulf of Alaska, they have to keep track of that process fairly closely.
College Ford was another place that had blood cattle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it does vary in its frequency from place to place and time to time. Yes?
I guess atmospheric questions are a little out of your specialty, but I wonder if you happen to know anything about the crazy weather this year in the U.S. as related to Pinatubo. Is there established, accepted relationship?
Well, they have what they feel is an established connection between Mount Pinatubo and climate. But really it was in last summer. Summer of 92, there might be some effect this year. They feel that the summer temperatures last year were depressed about a degree worldwide due to Mount Pinatubo. I don't know what their feeling is for this year, because that dust eventually settles out within a few years. So it would be less of an effect this year than last. The eruption was in the summer of 91, so we'd expect to see the big effect within the following year, basically. So yeah, it did have an effect.
They have pretty much decided in Minnesota, where we come from, that El Nino has done it to us, mm-hmm, this year.
In what way? Do you understand?
Well, El Nino is a warming of the Pacific Ocean west of South America, and then it changes west of South America, it changes the upper airflow, and what we've been doing is we've been getting that, and consequently all the rain. But another thing that's interesting, I don't know if everybody does this, but global warming, global cooling, there's no answer, because you can read one article this week from a research group that claims that we are in global warming, and if you watch your periodicals, your papers, you can pick up an article the next week. Another research group says, no, that's all wrong. We're cooling. So there's no... And in Minnesota, it's interesting that I have, even at my age, I have lived through a change. We now have more lakes, more water in Minnesota than when I was 10 years old. Minnesota is gaining more water all over the state. We have more lakes and more water now than we had in the 30s, so it's kind of interesting.
Well, one thing to remember with climate is that there are all kinds of cycles being superimposed on each other. And some of them we understand and some of them we don't understand. And all of those cycles will add up to give us a weather pattern that is very irregular. And interestingly, the period 1930 to 1960 was the period that the National Weather Service sort of arbitrarily decided to define as normal weather for the U.S. That was the period where they first had 30 good years of record, okay, all over the country. So they said, okay, we'll call this normal. 1930 to about 1960, thereabouts. And since then, the climate research has been, all these climate researchers have been going back, and geologists, and have been looking at sea cores or sediments in sea cores and in cores in the ice, and getting all this information about past climate. And we're finding that period, 1930 to 1960, was anomalously stable. It was unusually stable. And that climate over the last 10,000 years has been much more erratic than that period. So it's just what our definition of what normal is, in some ways, is having to be adjusted. And as I say, a lot of research is going on in climate right now. It's National Science Foundation has, big part of its pot of money is going toward climate research. And we're trying to understand it, because we want to know what these greenhouse gases are doing, that we're all the CO2 that we're creating from burning fossil fuels and cars and everything. Is this having an effect? Are we really, making a major mistake by letting these gases up there and causing irreparable harm, or is this going to be just part of the normal background fluctuations or not? And we need to understand our system a lot more than we do to be able to answer that question. Well, I've used up our time, so I thank you very much.
Okay.